Now, getting to our subject, I think we've just about finished with the Cosmos 1. We had Cosmos 2. We had the overthrow of the water, and when we draw the curtain for Cosmos 2, starting out in Genesis 1-2, water is covering everything. And the Spirit brooded upon the face of the deep. Now that word deep, in the Septuagint translation, the Greek word is abyssos. A-B-U-S-S-O-S, abyssos. From which we get the word abyss. And that same word is translated the bottomless pit in the Revelation. So at the beginning and the end of the Bible, we have also the abyss. Abyss. Which is evidently in the depth of the sea. Bottomless pit. The word bottomless doesn't occur in the word at all. It isn't there. It's an abyss. A great yawning place. And that fits in with some of the things we know from mythology and the like, and from Bible references. Now back in the beliefs of the ancient Greeks, the god of the sea was what we would call an equal to Satan, or another name for Satan, Neptune. The god who had the trident, three-pointed spear. And Neptune, you remember, in the stories of Hercules, was able to transform himself into most any form he pleased. He could be a serpent one minute. He could be some other great monster another minute, a fish and whatnot. He could transform himself into any form practically he pleased. And Satan can transform himself into an angel of light. So you can see the light. Now, when the demons were cast out into the swine ran down into the sea and were drowned. I don't know what became of the demons. It doesn't tell us. But they did say to him, or begged him, not to torment them before their time. They knew what was in store for them. They'd had a sentence passed upon them sometime before, probably during the first cosmos, see? These were some of the ones who had rebelled along with Satan. And today, you can see the same thing. Your greatest pits of iniquity and of vice and so on are along sea resorts, lake resorts, and whatnot. Water seems to have a drawing power for evils. Maybe you've never thought of that. And what a lot of destruction it can do, too. Still does. We look out here and see some of it right now. Of course, it isn't quite so bad now as it might be. So when we're introduced to this second cosmos, cosmos number 2, we are introduced to something that is chaotic because of something that's happened before. Now, I can take you through some of these words. I'll see how much time I have. Now, the present cosmos you find in 2 Peter 3:7. We had 2 Peter 3:6, which said that whereby the world that then was, being overflowed with water, perished. Now he says in verse 7, page 1868, but the heavens and the earth which are now, by the same word, are kept in store, reserved unto fire against the day of judgment and the perdition of ungodly men. And you have some more description of that over on the next page there. Verse 12, wherein the heavens, being on fire, shall be dissolved. This has to do with the heavens. And there's a lot of bodies in the heavens, almost uncountable. How much of that is to be dissolved, I don't know. Maybe all of it. Because as far as the eye can see with a telescope, there is evidence of ruin and disruption. There's an orderly arrangement of most of it, going in clockwork time and so on. And yet, in our own solar system, we have remnants of some terrific catastrophe. One of the planets sometime has been smashed to pieces and is going around in its orbit in bits. And we don't know what happened. There is evidence that maybe this Earth at one time was in another solar system. And this overthrow had to do with its being thrown down from another position or another sun system. It wouldn't be anything new because the same thing happened to Venus. It one time did not belong to this cosmos, but drifted in some way in the shape of a comet and had a tangle with the Earth at the time of the Exodus from Egypt. In fact, there was two different ones at times of that tangling up, according to records, and finally took its place as, settled down, took its place as a planet. Now, it's not in the ancient records of the planets at all, and yet it can be plainly seen by the eye, and some people who have exceptionally good eyes can even see the phases, like the moon, when it's half shown, a crescent, and full, and so on. Because of being close to the sun, we see different sides of it. However, we have know nothing of the surface of Venus. It's covered with vapor, clouds, and whatnot, and the surface of it has never been seen. We just see the vapors and clouds and so on covered. Now, there are some ancient legends that our mice and rats came from Venus. I don't think they could live there now because the temperature is terrific over where it is now. It's next to the sun, one of the closest to the sun, you see. Now, those are a few facts of astronomy to bring in here, which show that there is a close relationship with some of the things we have shown to us in the Bible. And so I say this overthrow of the earth, now, if it did, then this water that had been overflowed at one time probably was frozen solid if it was cast from one system into the other, because then there would be no heat to see. And there's some evidence that at one time it was covered with ice. And then there would take a long period of time for that to melt. Now, how many years this overthrow lasted, you see, we don't know. We have no idea. There have been different periods of it, different creations in that, different kinds of animals and plants in each of these periods, but it's been overthrow after overthrow until finally there's a restoration in the chapter 1 of Genesis, and it is fitted up for man to live on. Now, there's no evidence that mankind has ever seen the great dinosaur. That is, the family of Adam. Now, if there were people living on this earth sometime before Adam, I don't know. And it doesn't bother me a bit if there were. Now, this book and God's dealing today is with the children of Adam. So whatever went before and so on is none of our business. Now, it doesn't worry me one bit. If they dig up the remains of some man and they can prove it was long before Adam, that doesn't bother me a bit. He's had his day, and God has dealt with him if he had any dealing with him, and that's over. So we don't need to worry ourselves about that. But what God is dealing with now, in this present time, is with Adam's race. And also some principalities and powers, and we don't know very much about that. We don't know how, for instance, that the redemptive work of Christ really affected principalities and powers. We don't know. Because they don't have the same status that we have. We know that they're in there. We know that the redemptive work of Christ had to go out as far in the creation as sin and death have reached. We know that. It wouldn't be complete if it didn't. The glory of God could never fill all the creation unless all of that creation is cleansed and the redemptive work applied, and so God's glory can fill all of it. We know that much, but the details we can't fill in. All we know is the big, broad outline. And if we are bothered by some of these things, and they worry us and so on, give us doubts and so on, we're just not trusting the Lord to take care of His creation. I believe He can, and I believe He does. And I'm not worried about those things. I'm not worried about what's going on in the world today. Oh, I can I can suggest, like I did to some of the folks last night, I can suggest some things by which society might benefit itself. But I know they're not going to do it. And why should I worry? God has these things in control. I wrote an article, maybe you folks remember, about the testing ground. An article I wrote quite some time ago. Now, if you're going to help out the folks at Detroit who are building automobiles, if you want to help them out, you don't go in there and improve our testing ground. But you go in, if you want to really be of help, you go in there and help them to build a car that'll stand the test. You know what I mean? And the Christian has no business of making this world a better world today. That isn't his commission. It's his business to strengthen the brethren so that they can stand the test. That's our business. Well, I know there's a great temptation to meddle in the things of the world. I know it's natural for all of us to be very concerned about our families and our relatives, and we'd like to water down the plan of salvation so we get all of our family and our relatives in, you know. That's a natural tendency. You see it on all hands. I know a preacher told me one time, he said, my Sunday school superintendent is the greatest detriment I have in the church. His plan of salvation is so wide, he gets his whole family in. And it is a bad example and teaching for the rest of the church. I just have to get a little of that in to introduce this. So we see what we're looking at, what we're working at. We just have to see something of God's side of these things, why things are as they are, in order to understand it. Because I have had scores of people come to me and say, well, why does this have to happen to me? Like Job, questioning God, his judgment. Well, I'm happy that I'm still alive. It's not by any worth of my own that I am. It's only by the grace of God. He's under no obligation to preserve our lives. And under less obligation to give us everlasting life and a resurrection. If we got what we deserved, we wouldn't have any. Now, why? There's a question comes out again now. Why? Well, why does God show this grace? Why does he, we'll use the word save people who are so undeserving? Why did he come in the flesh and die for the ungodly and take away the sin of the world, not impute their sins against him? Why? Well, in the first place, we know this, and we had this verse a while ago. In Ephesians 3, that is making known by the church the manifold wisdom of God, the principalities and powers in the heavenly places. And for you and me to give a message of life to folks, that is one of the things we have to bring out. The love and the grace of God. Now, why does God love mankind? Just to get cold facts. Why should he love mankind? I think we have the answer in Genesis 1:26. He's made in the likeness of the image of his Son. And remember that God loved his Son. It was only for Christ's sake that God has loved us. In spite of all of our rebellion, our failure, and our selfishness, and our following after the things of the world, and even being a tool of the devil at times, there's God's love, and it's everlasting. What I mean by everlasting is he loves us until the end of our life. Whether we believe or whether we don't. Don't ever make the mistake that a Sunday school teacher did in teaching a class of youngsters that God loves those who are good children. God loves good little children. Terrible mistake. God loves a bad little children too. And maybe, like in some of our human families, if there could be any degree to it, I think that quite often in a human family, that the one who errs and who is rebellious against the parents is loved really more than the one who is obedient and conforms to the wishes of the parents. Quite often that is true. And probably that is about true with God. Israel rejected their Messiah and had him crucified by the Romans. They wouldn't stone him themselves because they were afraid of the responsibility. They wanted to slip out of that. So they had their own charge, and he had blasphemed, and that was enough for them to stone him. But they were afraid to do it because of the people and so on. They didn't want the responsibility, so they trumped up another charge that he was a king, making himself a king instead of Caesar, to get a verdict of sedition against him. So he would be killed by the Romans, which they did. But they had the responsibility. They handed him over. And then, with all of that, he said, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. And that was all true. They didn't know what they were doing. And Peter said so at Pentecost. That they unknowingly had killed the Prince of Peace. Because they didn't know who he was. Now, if he could say that to see them, right in the face of that rebellion and that murder and so on. And then another side of that is, if he could do that, who are we to judge people and to entertain any hate or anything like that for them? No business with that sort of thing at all. We may hate the things they do. They hate their ways and so on, but we must love the people. I had a mother tell me once that she disliked so much some of the things one of her sons was doing that she said she just practically hated him. And then he changed. And the last I knew, I think he was doing some missionary work in South America. And he certainly did change. Way back, years ago, he was one of those motorcycle riders. You know what I mean. So when we get into this study here, we have to keep these things in mind. What God is doing. And where we stand, and so on. So we come in, we introduce ourselves to this Cosmos 2. In which we now live, the second earth, the second heaven. And so in 2 Peter 3:7, the heavens and the earth which are now are kept in store. It's condemned from the start as far as the cosmos itself is concerned. But out of that is being worked a plan, a purpose, a redemptive work in the midst of all of this ruin and all of this rebellion and with all of the satanic forces in the heavens above us. So on, God is working out a plan and a purpose. And there are people being reserved until a day that he can make use of them, resurrect them, and bring them into a real sonship and into the heaven of heavens. For there is a work awaiting us, and we have no idea of what it is to be. Be among principalities and powers, in the family of God, as we spoke of, among the saints in the heavens. But that's about all we know. We have 7 days in Genesis 1, 6 days of work, and 1 day of rest, and I told you that we had no knowledge of that until Moses wrote it in a book, so it was not made known to mankind until about 1,491 years after Adam. No, I'll put it the other way around, 1,491 years B.C. Now you'll have to figure the rest. Subtract that from 4,004 and you have the correct figure. In other words, we can say this too, that the only gospel that men knew for almost 2,500 years was not a written word in books or on clay and the like, but a gospel was written in the stars. And the key had been given to that, to Adam, to Enoch, Abraham, Noah, and others, so that they knew what that was. The key was given. I've just written recently a little article on the other sheet in John. And a lot of folks stumbled over that. The gospel in the stars gives you a pretty good idea of it. There are two sheepfolds. We call them the small and the great dipper, the small and great bear. But they're sheepfolds, really, in the original. The language is given, or names given them. And you see that there's a difference between the two, again. And so at the time of our Lord and the time of the apostles and during Acts, there was a remnant. Paul speaks of them in the Romans, a remnant of Israel who believed. But of course the prophecies tell us that someday they will say, blessed is he who cometh in the name of the Lord, and there'll be a great multitude coming out of great tribulation. A multitude no one can number, it says in Revelation. That's a greater sheepfold. There's a space between a 2,000 year period in round numbers. The same with the two fishes in the signs of the zodiac. The fishes, Pisces. There's two groups of believers for the time interval between. You also have Andromeda in the stars. The woman, Israel, chained to the rock. And her deliverer someday would deliver. But today, Israel is helpless, chained to the rock. But the deliverer will come. So you see all of this gospel, Israel, and the stars and so on, Israel and all of these things are told in the stars. And yet, you can go through Moses, you can go through the gospel in the stars, you can read all of the writings up till you get to Ephesians, and not a whisper concerning the mystery of what it is. They'll give you the time period. Hosea speaks about 2 days, and in the third day he will raise Israel up. He even describes the condition of Israel during that time in Hosea. Without a prince. Without an ephod, after sacrifice, and so on. But doesn't tell you anything of the character of that theory. What God is going to be doing to anybody else. What he's going to be doing to the world in that theory. And so you can see that when Satan got Israel at the end of Acts to reject as a nation the re-offer of their Messiah, and they were turned over to blindness, he thought he had the whole thing tied up and in the bag. Because so far, up to that, the only blessing that the nations of the earth were ever to get was through the channel of Israel. That's what they were chosen for. And so if Israel were to reject their Messiah and not be that channel of blessing, as far as Satan knew, that was the finish. And then out comes the Satan. Hid from ages and generations, hid in God. And this secret had to do with a place that Satan had aspired to and couldn't get there. And further than that, it has to do with a people who will inherit that place that he wanted to go to. When you get that much straight, we begin to see the difference between the earthly and the heavenly programs. There is an earthly program, and Israel will someday be a minister to the nation. The 12 apostles will fulfill that great commission in Matthew 28. Nobody else has taken it. There's no succession of apostleship. As far as the 12 apostles are concerned, they are going to do the very thing that God chose them to do sometime. And nobody else is going to take it, excepting in the one instance. When one of them failed, a dropout, and Matthias took his place. And let us be careful that in this particular age, as some of us are not a dropout and somebody takes our place, it can happen. Probably has happened in a number of instances. I say that because that there are some people who have gotten a false idea, and they have grabbed onto this idea in Colossians that We are complete in Christ, filled to the full in Christ. Therefore, like a great many of the Pentecostals and others, we can't sin. We go out and do as we please according to the flesh. Now, we can do as we please in the new nature. That's right. But when we have that new nature in us, we please to do the things that please God. And so these things can be taken hold of some who have gotten only a little smattering of the truth, a little head knowledge instead of down in the heart, and are trying to make capital of it and mislead a lot of folks, cause a lot of folks to stumble. Now, when we really know the mystery and know Christ as the head of the church, which is his body, then things will change. We want to do his will. Let him work through us. And we'll spend our Saturday night a little differently than what we once did. Now, let's look at Matthew 4, 8 and 9. The question is, who is the ruler of the nations today? Who is the world ruler today? And this answers, and he saith unto him, that is, the devil says to Christ, wait a minute, I skipped the 8th verse. Then again, the devil taketh up into an exceeding high mountain and showeth him all the kingdoms of the world and the glory of them, and saith unto him, all these things will I give thee, if thou wilt fall down and worship me. Who is the ruler of this cosmos? Satan. And he had the power to do that, and the Lord did not argue with him about it. He didn't contradict him. He just said, Satan, you don't have that power. Satan has been given that power, that's true. He couldn't have it unless it was given to him, but there's a purpose in it, back of it. That for the time being, he is the ruler of this cosmos. And that is a part of the testing. Now, he can only go so far. We know the limitations when we read the preface to Job, and we can see how far he can go. Now, Satan can touch us and control us in the old nature, but he cannot touch the new life, the new nature. And so it was with Job. He could take away anything that Job had excepting his life. That was a picture. I've had people ask me from time to time, well, and of course they're pointing out to somebody when they do this. They say, well, can a Christian do those things? And I just tell them right off, well, a Christian can do anything that anybody else can. He's got that old nature yet. Sure he can. And there are Christians who do those things. No getting around it. We have examples in our Bible along that line. Look at David, a man after God's own heart, and look how he stumbled himself, rationalized himself into believing that it was all right for him to take another man's wife and to take the other man's life. But remember this, that when he was just reminded of it by the prophet Nathan, that touched him to the quick. He was repentant right away. That's the spirit. See? That's what endeared David in the sight of God. Now, there are some who would be rebuked like that, and they'd only harden their hearts and maybe have a prophet killed, which happened many, many times in the Old Testament. When a prophet brought the truth to light, he might have been thrown in two, as Isaiah is supposed to have been, thrown in the dungeons, in the pit, and whatnot. But David didn't do that. And so, Satan could offer the kingdoms of this world. He had it in hand, he had it in his power to do so at that time. And he probably still has that same power. And someday there's a man coming along who will accept his offer, his own son, We call him the beast or the antichrist. And then we can see things work out pretty fast. That's when things really begin to boil. In Ephesians 2:2, to pick out of that, according to the prince of the power of the air, the spirit that now worketh in the children of disobedience. The prince of the power of the air. No question of who that is. So that's another name. He's a ruler of nations. He's prince of the power of the air. In Daniel 10, 13 and 20, we find other princes. Daniel had prayed, and a messenger had been sent to him, but he was delayed 3 weeks. And he says, but the prince of the kingdom of Persia withstood me 21 days, but lo, Michael, one of the chief princes, came to help me, and I remained there with the kings of Persia. Now I am come to make thee understand what shall befall thy people, that is Israel, in the latter days, for yet the vision is for many days. And then I said also, verse 20, then said he, knowest thou there, wherefore I come unto thee? And now will I return to fight with the prince of Persia. When I am gone forth, lo, the prince of Grecia shall come. So there you have two princes, prince of Grecia and the prince of Persia, who are mighty beings in the air, in the heaven, that this man had to come through, to come from God, to speak to Daniel. And they withstood him. Now, of course, we have hints in Ephesians and Colossians that there was a mighty battle in the air when Christ ascended with his host of angels and took captives. I don't know what kind of procession they had. The idea is that they were like in the old processions they used to have. They would put chains on the captives and lead them behind the chariot of the victor in a public procession through the street. And among some of the heathen, they had one favorite way of doing it. They put hooks, as they call them, fish hooks, at the ring, really, in the noses of these captives, and lead them along by those. They like to be led around by those. And so there was a mighty battle of some kind when the Lord ascended. And some of these were conquered. Well, that opens up the way, at least. I'll just inquire how much significance and so on. I don't know. That's as far as I can go with. I haven't any detail. I just have that much. There are a lot of people in the world who, especially on Sunday morning, will pray, "Thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven." But is God's will being done in that heaven today? I should say not. When you really boil it down, this prayer is valid for only a 3.5-year period in the future. When Israel comes into her tribulation or her time of trouble, this is a prayer Israel will pray. This is a tribulation prayer. When Satan is cast out at the beginning of the tribulation, then God's will is being done in heaven. Then they can pray this prayer. And thy kingdom come, in 3.5 years it will come. So the prayer will be answered. And then, when the king comes, the will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Very simple, isn't it? Places it. It's a time element. Everything all is right there in your prophecies and intimated in this prayer. We have no business praying that prayer now. And besides, we who are members of the church, which is the body of Christ, are not asking for his kingdom here on the earth anyhow. Our hope is a heavenly hope. That prayer is none of our business. Don't expect to be here when that kingdom comes. Don't expect to have any part in it whatsoever. Now, I may be able to wander around over the universe from my place in the heavenlies, see these things are going on. I don't doubt but what we can travel over the whole universe by thought instantly at any point, even if it is 4.5 million light years away. It'll be a different kind of beings than we are now. It won't be dust. I say, we don't know anything about spiritual things. We have some idea. You see, we have some things that we can't explain, even in the material world. There are three things that you don't know and I don't. The first thing is, what is life? Sometimes it's spoken of in the Bible as soul. What is soul or life? It does tell us where it is. Where a man's soul is. It's in the blood. But you cannot produce life in a test tube in the laboratory in absolutely sterile condition. The second thing we do not know is what electricity is. There's evidence that it's throughout the universe. But we don't know what it is. We have harnessed it. We know its ways, how it does. We get a little shocked at it once in a while. But we know what it is. And then a third thing. Life. We don't know what it is. We use it. We couldn't live without it. There couldn't be life as we know it without light. And I suspect electricity, if that was all turned off, there wouldn't be any life either. Organically, we're just getting to learn some of the things electricity has to do with a plant growth. And it has a great place to play it. But light. Can you explain how that light can come 93 million miles through way sub-zero space and produce heat here on the Earth? Can you explain it? God knew what he was doing. Why, he's so far ahead of the scientists and the theologians, too. It just takes a few questions just like that to show us how little that we know. And yet here we're making use of it all the time. We go and push the switch and have light. Don't know what it is. We eat in order to preserve life. Don't know what it is. And we go out and take sun baths and we eat all of the vegetables and good stuff that the sun makes possible for us, and we don't know what light is. Now, if we don't know those three things, how are we going to expect to know heavenly things, as the Lord said to Nicodemus? He says, if I show you earthly things and you don't understand, how can I show you heavenly things? There it is. Now, Satan will be cast out in Revelation 12:9. And when all comes to perfection and evil is out, then someday will come that great fire, Peter 3:7. But there's a great conflict on in the meantime. I've spoken to you folks before about how that the book of Revelation is shown by the game of chess. The two kings, the two queens, the two religious systems, the bishops, the two armies, the knights, and the strongholds, the two castles, and the pawns on the one side, and the white ones, if the pawns are faithful unto death, they get into the king row, or whatever you want to call it, and the pawns on the black side are destined for destruction as the tares. In other words, they're the children of God on the one side and the children of evil on the other. The fallen. Showing us the end of the great conflict of the ages and what it's leading up to. Satan has exercised his power in many ways on the earth. The great whirlwinds that destroyed the possessions, the children of Job. The storm that was destined or supposed to destroy the Son of Man on the Lake of Galilee. And many things that he has done. And yet this one that Satan wanted to destroy has passed through the heavens, as we find in Hebrews 9:24. Now we can trace that on this a little bit. I had a notion to put this in, and I thought, well, I wouldn't clutter this up anymore. It's bad enough now as it is. But over in here some way, we might put an arrow here from the earth up here into this. The ascension of Christ. It'll come way over here in there. If I am right of this being around 12,000 years, I forget. I've spoken of that before. That'd be the number of, at least of dominion as a given man. 12 is the number of dominion. And we know that there's a long period after the millennium of day and night in which Satan will be in the lake of fire before the new heaven and new earth come in where there is no night. So we know there's a great period there. And it might be a 5,000 year period. I don't know. But we do have it pretty certain that the 7,000 years from Adam is the great Sabbath or day of rest for Israel. And in the seventh month is when they have their feast of the ingathering or tabernacle, which would correspond. And you see there's 12 months in the year. Again, making your 12,000 years. So there's a lot of things that point to that. Also, the fact is that in the month of Israel, there were no activities in the fifth and sixth month. And of course, this period, the 2,000 years in which we're in the latter part of, is the fifth and sixth millennium. So Israel didn't have any activities in that time. There, that's a study in itself. And you might want to go into that. But to give you a little idea of the pattern here, at least, we have something of it. Now, how long this might be, I wouldn't know. It might be 24,000 years. I don't know. Now, the reason I said it might be 24,000 years is because I know it'll be about 24,000 years for the sun to have started in the beginning with all of the cycles, which you'll find in number in Scripture, I believe it is. All of the cycles to finish all of that, the whole 12 signs of the zodiac in which it starts from year to year to get over to here. Take about 24,000 years. Now, it might go beyond that. See, I don't know. But we have a new heaven and new earth over here and no need of the sun and the moon, so I figure that time period, that time element is all left there. And it wouldn't extend over into it. Of course, that's a guess. But I don't see any need of it after that because our times as we have them now are finished. Well, that's something else you think about. Now, the cosmos of the future. And Paul speaks of this. Turn to 2 Corinthians 12, 1-4. Paul is speaking. It is not expedient for me doubtless to glory. Paul says, it is not expedient for me to be a bragger. And Paul never did. Paul was never boasting. He says it isn't expedient. And I don't think it is for any of us. Excepting he does qualify that a little bit. And he says he can boast in Christ Jesus. In other words, it's the Lord that does it, not he. I will come to visions and revelations of the Lord. Now tell us a little something about that. I knew a man. A lot of folks will just skip that entirely. And they'll say, well, I at one time did this. But Paul doesn't say that. He says, I knew a man. for that was in Paul. I knew a man in Christ about 14 years ago, and we might as well just skip the parenthesis because the other man tells us whether it's in the body or not. Such an one caught up to the third heaven. Heaven 3 over here on the right. 8:3. Right above Revelation 21:2. See it? Under the circle. Paul says he knew a man that was caught up to that third heaven. In other words, he was taken up to see that. He got in a time machine and was projected way into the future and saw what would be going on at that time. Paul says he knew such a man. And he says, I knew such a man, how that he was caught up into paradise and heard unspeakable words which is not lawful for a man to utter. Well, now you have some. Who was this man that Paul knew that was caught up into the third heaven and also saw paradise? I got paradise labeled right here. The new earth is paradise. That's where the dying malefactor is headed, the new earth. Christ said that he would be with him in paradise. That's still future. That doesn't exist yet today. That comes in the next cosmos. That's for the present cosmos to destroy the fire. Be a new heavens and new earth in which we all right. And so, Paul said he knew a man who was caught up, saw things in the third heaven, and also caught up, saw things in paradise, and heard things was not lawful for him to utter. That gives you the key, you know exactly who it was. Because that man testified. He said he was going to write down what the seven thunders uttered, and he was forbidden to do so. He couldn't utter. He couldn't write. Now, who was this man that Paul knew?
Paul himself.
John. And in the Revelation, there you have it. John was caught up to the third heaven. He saw the temple therein. He saw the Ark of the Testimony. He was caught up into the third, in the paradise. He saw there the new Jerusalem coming down to the new earth of paradise. And John had seen this and written the book of Revelation around 14 years before Paul wrote 2 Corinthians. Now, about when was the book of Revelation written? You got the date?
43.
About 43. All right, and 14 years later, be about 57 when Paul wrote 2 Corinthians, right? You begin to get your dates, begin to get your men straightened out. So Paul knew John, and knew that John had had this revelation, no doubt read it. And so he's telling, 14 years after John had had this vision, written the book of Revelation, Paul says, I knew a man, caught up into the third heaven, caught up into paradise. If you want, about those, that uttering business there, you'll find that in Revelation 10:4, I believe. Seven thunders uttered their voices in verse 3. Then in 4, and when the seven thunders had uttered their voices, I was about to write. And I heard a voice from heaven saying unto me, seal up those things which the seven thunders uttered, and write them not. So you see, it was unlawful for him to utter the things which he heard. How these key together if we only look. Now, there's a lot of other references too, this same way, which shows the early writing of the Revelation and what John heard and how it keys in with other things. Wonderful when you begin to see how this Bible is. And here, tradition of the early centuries is telling us that the book of Revelation is written about AD 100 or 96 or somewhere along there. And if that is true, then it contradicted everything that Paul taught in his prison epistle. It's impossible. All of the revelations concerning the kingdom was finished before Paul wrote Ephesians. Now comes in a new revelation. Why would we have somebody coming in and going back to an old dispensation again after Paul has given the new one? It isn't even sense. And another thing they tried to tell us is that the Gospel of John was written way back around A.D. 90. Now, it is true, it is written a long time after the Revelation is written. That's true. But we can get its position just from the first chapter when we read there that he came into his own, and his own received him not, but as many as received him, to them gave he the power to become the children of God. That's speaking of Acts 28:28, when Israel was given up. They rejected their Messiah. And so John's Gospel is written sometime pretty soon after or immediately after Acts 28:28. But he's not giving us anything concerning the mystery. John didn't have any part in there. His name was written, one of the foundations of the walls of New Jerusalem. And he had no part in the mystery. That's the reason why Paul was such a separate apostle. He had an apostleship for the kingdom for a while, and then it was changed over to that of the mystery. But the calling of the 12 apostles is unchanged. And they have a ministry to do in the future here on the earth. So Paul was given the great privilege of changing dispensation, along with many others of that time. So when this time comes, and his own had received him not, Paul has then, or John has then, the great message of John 3:16. That regardless of dispensation, of any family of God, or sons of God, there are those who believing can receive life through his name, and have a resurrection and be in this paradise, the new earth. As I was telling somebody just a few minutes ago, that is where the bulk of Christendom today, that is people who believe on the life, that's where they're headed. They can't have part in the kingdom, which was closed almost over 1900 years ago. And they don't know anything about the mystery, and they can't have a part in it if they don't know, because you receive things by faith. Therefore, they have only one thing left, and that is paradise. That occurs a long time before this. Of course, now there'd be a great many people in the great white throne judgment who will go into this, or our post-millennial kingdom at least. You see, that great white throne judgment may come 5,000 years before the end of this cosmos in which we are now. And those folks can go into the post-millennial kingdom and have part on the earth as it is now, and also go on into the next. Now, another question that somebody brought up was this, about Abraham. Now, I'm aware of the fact that there's a class teaching along these lines that did teach, I don't know what they're doing now, but a few years ago they were teaching that Abraham had a choice. That he could have the land that was promised to him in the first place, or he could go further than that, he could have the New Jerusalem, but he couldn't have both. But he's going to have both. We're told very plainly, the Lord said, that many should come from the east and west and sit down with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in the kingdom. Also in Hebrews, we're told that Abraham was looking for a city whose foundation, a New Jerusalem. And there's no reason why they shouldn't. Now, I think I spoke of it once today, and I will bring it down again. You can look into this. In studying chapters 2 and 3 of the Revelation to these seven churches, you will find four of these are given promises which have to do with the new earth, the new Jerusalem. And the other three promises that have to do with the kingdom. That's one thing that led me into a study of that a number of years ago, was when I was looking at these and tabulating them with some squares on paper and getting the things that are against the churches, the fault was found with them, and the blessings were promised and so on, tabulating them. I discovered that there wasn't any difference here, particularly between the millennium and the New Jerusalem in these promises. And I thought, well, if God is not making a difference between these and separating them, and some have one and some have the other, and not having both, well, what business have I trying to separate? So I just abandoned that idea right there. That the believers who go through the millennium and post-millennial kingdom will go right on later into the New Jerusalem, the new heavens, new earth. And of course, that's for Israel. It has the 12 gates, the 12 tribes of Israel. No gates for Gentiles. I don't know what part they'll play there. Doesn't tell us. We do know that outside of that New Jerusalem will be the nations of the earth with them that are saved, we find in the Revelation. Paradise. And Adam, no doubt, will be there and enjoy the light of this New Jerusalem, which will light the whole world. There won't be any need for the sun or the moon. There won't be any night. And Adam will be there in that paradise, enjoying all that, and many others besides. So we have a future cosmos coming. 2 Peter 3:13. We spoke of this in 2 Corinthians. Now we look at 2 Peter. Nevertheless, we, and Peter is talking about himself and his Jewish brethren, believers, nevertheless, we, according to his promise, now these folks have a part in the promise, as you see, covenants of promise, which we Gentiles don't have. So he's speaking for himself and the believers of Israel at that time. Nevertheless, we, according to his promise, look for new heavens and a new earth wherein dwelleth righteousness. And if it's righteousness dwells there probably won't be any unrighteousness. And of course, we have other scriptures which tell us concerning the fact that this will be perfect. Sin and death will long ago have been done away with. Also, in connection with that, well, let's take a look at Revelation 21:1, which we have over here on the left of that, under the circle there, Revelation 21:1. Just see what it says. I can tell you easily, but if you read it for yourself, it sticks a little better. You don't have to believe me, you believe the book then. You see, this way, I can pass the buck. I can say, well, I didn't say it, God said it. So you can't jump onto me about it. If you disagree about it and so on, you have to take it up with God, not with me, see? So I can get out of the blame of the whole thing. Of course, some people get so mad because we remind them of these things, you see. They don't want to see it. They don't want to know that's there. They don't want to read that verse. And they just get awfully warm in the collar if you remind them of it or point it out to them. They don't want to know what God has said. It doesn't agree with their particular creed or doctrine, their idea. And I saw a new heaven and a new earth. For the former is what it really is in the Greek, the former, that's the one it is now. Heaven and the former earth were passed away. And there was no more sea. Now, we'll hit the second verse there after a while, but I don't want to mix you up with that right now. I have one other one concerning the earth. Let's look at Luke 23:43. Isn't a bad idea if you make a little change in the punctuation in your Bible. Of course, now, originally, there's no punctuation in this whatsoever. This is a later invention, not too many hundred years ago. But in the original Greek, there was no punctuation, no division in the paragraphs, chapters, or even sentences, or even in the words. It was all written just in one long string. So punctuation has been added. The verses have been added, and the chapters, and so on. And sometimes they've been a little unfortunate in making their divisions. But it's a great help in study to have them, and I wouldn't want to change them now. And Jesus said unto the dying malefactor, verily I say unto thee today, comma, thou shalt be with me in paradise. Now this is an old Hebrew idiom. Many times you find it in the Old Testament. Verily I say unto you today. And of all days that he should say, that day is his humiliation, his dying on the cross. On such a day as He said to this fellow, thou shalt be with me in paradise. Well, this isn't any answer to the man's question at all, his request. Because he had said, Lord, remember me when thou comest into thy kingdom. Well, the kingdom comes a long, long time before paradise. Well, that gives us a hint, too. We have a pretty good idea to start with. This man was a malefactor, probably a slave, or maybe a Roman, I don't know. If he was a Roman citizen, he couldn't be there in that position because they couldn't kill a man, a Roman citizen, on the stake. But at least he must not have been a Jew. Or he could have entered into the kingdom. But he isn't. He's refused that, and he said he'd have a part in paradise. Picking up the New Jerusalem, now you are just looking at Revelation 21. Now we can go back to that. 21:2. The New Jerusalem, as such, is mentioned in three different books in the Bible. Never in the Old Testament. Mentioned first in the New Testament in the book of Revelation, which was written before Galatians and Hebrews. It's mentioned in Galatians and Hebrews, both written by Paul. So John and Paul are the only ones in all the Bible that speak concerning the New Jerusalem. Now there's one reference to it, but not by name. But John also writes that in his gospel. In John 14, in my Father's house, in my Father's palace, are many apartments. And when we read the description of it and the measurements of it in the book of Revelation, we find that that's a pretty good size apartment building. Possibly in the shape of a cube, 1,500 miles square and 1,500 miles high. And beings that are made out of the dust of the earth don't inhabit that. Because if we get up a little over around 5 miles high, we have to have a tank of oxygen to help out. As they climb Mount Everest, for instance, have to carry along oxygen. That's almost 6 miles high, right around there. Think of 1,500 miles. And the express elevators and all of that. And we know that that's got to be inhabited by resurrected people. People who have received the new nature and have nothing of Adam left in them. Because they'd be out digging up the streets. The streets are a go. And not only that, but they'd be rearranging. They'd be tearing it up and putting in something new and all of that sort of thing. There won't be any of that. Here and now, men will build something with wonderful plans and so on, and you haven't got it much more than settled, and they tear it all up to put in some wires and sewers and pipe or water lines and whatnot and whatnot. But this is going to have a planner and a builder that's not going to make any mistake. There's going to be no change. Just a few of the thoughts you can think about and going on. Now, there'll be no need of light switches. Be no night there. And this city will be light, luminous. And remember that gold in its most pure form they have discovered, as it tells in the description of the New Jerusalem, is transparent. You see, science keeps verifying the Bible. I mean, the Bible keeps verifying science. See? We're finding out something all the time new. And we think it's new, and here it's already been known. It's just verifying what the Bible said. Not too awfully many years ago, there were people who hooted and laughed at the idea that there's an empty place in the north, in the sky. Astronomers that didn't know much back in those days and didn't have big telescopes that said, why, the sky is covered all over with stars. There's no empty space. And after they put that big 200-inch reflector in at Mount Palomar near Los Angeles. And started searching the skies of that. They found up past the North Star a great blank black place in the sky. There's nothing. That's the North. That's the access to the heavens above. The place where Satan said he would ascend the sides of the North. The gateway out of the universe. How little we know. And now they found out that Job was right. Job had said that there was this empty space in the North Sea. And Job also said the earth is hung upon nothing. That's true. There's no chain holding the earth up. There isn't any giant holding the sky on his shoulders. There's no big turtle with the earth resting on his shell. All of those ancient ideas hangs on nothing. And here's Job, the oldest book in the Bible. And he talks about the constellation. Of course, before that they began to worship the host of heaven and so on, people had known these things. By the time Job was getting his story out, and hadn't all of these things been corrupted to such an extent that they still knew some of them. And he speaks of different constellations and so on. It's more about astronomy and Job than all the rest of the Bible put together. Well, going on. Revelation 21:2, and I, John, saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down from God out of heaven, prepared as a bride adorned for a husband. I read just a little bit of that. And I heard a great voice out of heaven saying, behold, the tabernacle of God, the dwelling of God. God is dwelling now with man. He had dwelt in the tabernacle in the wilderness, in the Holy of Holies, in the midst of the encampment of Israel. But here's a closer relationship here, because there isn't any temple here, no tabernacle in it. He's dwelling with men themselves directly, not in a building. There's no temple there. And he will dwell with them, and they shall be his people, and God himself shall be with them and be their God. And God shall wipe away all tears from their eyes, and there shall be no more death, neither sorrow nor crying, neither shall there be any more pain. For the former things have passed away. He that sat upon the throne said, behold, I make all things new. God is not satisfied with reformation. It must be a new creation. All things new. Everything that we have in us, that we inherited from Adam, died. All in Adam died. But there's a new creation within the believer. That's what goes on. And so we forget these things of the flesh, the desires of the flesh and so on. Remember, the five senses have to do with the flesh. And they are the entrances to that old nature. Those are the ways by which Satan can attack one, not through the new nature. And he said unto me, write, for these words are true and faithful. Notice there's a special thing here for him to write. He's to write something he's heard. In the beginning, when he writes this book, he's told to write the things he's seen. That's one reason why he couldn't write what the seven thunders uttered. But here he's told to write what he's heard. So this is one exception. But in the main, the book of Revelation is the things that he's seen. And he said unto me, it is done. This is the end of the wrath of God. Sin and death is gone. The vials of wrath have been poured out upon the kingdom and his seat. Devil has been destroyed. And so on. All of this evil is gone. So he says it is done. Now the work that brought about this was finished on Calvary. But here it's really carried out. In other words, we have something that is de jure, that is, a sentence, then he had de facto, it's done. So everything that Christ died for and planned for now has come to its complete realization and fulfillment. Now, he has been made head of all things in heaven and earth, which we don't see as yet. In fact, he had said in Matthew 28 that all power is given to him in heaven and earth. We don't see it as yet. But whenever he takes over that power, then is a signal for the 12 apostles in resurrection to begin that great commission that was given to them, to evangelize the nations and baptize them in the triune name, which they never have done yet. But the day will come, and he says, and I will be with you even unto the end of the age. That is, until the end of the millennium. The millennium is a time when they will do this work, and the Lord will be with them personally. So they're not on their own alone. Now, they did have a commission given in Mark on which they were on their own. And they did that. They finished it. And it says, and the signs followed. So that was finished. But this is one that isn't finished. They haven't even started. So you see, the apostles had two different commissions. One, an immediate one in Mark, in which they finished in their lifetime. And one which they're to do in the future in resurrection in the millennium. Now, there's another case of right division to keep those separate. There's nothing about speaking in tongues and signs and so on in Matthew 28. There's no indication of any of that in the millennium. But there was during the period of Acts. In their immediate commission they were given, they could do all sorts of miracles, take up snakes, drink poison, raise the dead, speak in tongues and whatnot. There's no evidence, nothing to tell us that that'll ever be repeated. That had its purpose and it's done. And that'll answer a lot of questions. I am Alpha and Omega, the beginning and the end. I will give unto him that is athirst of the fountain of water of life freely. He that overcometh shall inherit all things, and I will be his God, and he shall be my son. But the fearful and unbelieving and the abominable and murderers and whoremongers and sorcerers and idolaters and all liars, and these are all particular in having a place in the great tribulation, shall have their part in the lake which burneth with fire and brimstone, which is the second death. Or in other words, that's the end of it. Whenever you see a lake of fire, you can just make up your mind that that means that's the end of that, whether it's death or hell or the tares or whatever it may be. That's the termination. Now, well, unto the end of the age or unto the age of the ages and whatever those are, it has to do with ages. Not eternity as we think of the name. When the new heavens and new earth come in, there won't be any more of that. Everything will be absolutely perfect there. Satan will be gone. All of the unbelievers be forgotten. Their memory perished, as it tells us time after time in the Old Testament. No remembrance of them. And in that new heaven and new earth, there will be no signs, nothing left of the monuments that have been building in this age. Everything will be erased and all put in perfect order. Now, he can carve all he wants to in the mountain, pictures and inscriptions, and set up all kinds of monuments and buildings and so on, these steel and these concrete and so on. They'll all go up in smoke. No remembrance of former things. A good thing. We don't want to remember any of these former things, either in heaven or earth. There is nothing said in the Bible about any person ever being cast alive into fire excepting two persons. Alive into fire. And that is a beast and a false prophet. And of course, the instant they'd be cast into it, that'd be the end of them. If it was something like a volcano or something like that. If it were literal. Or it's just their termination. And then we find that Satan is later cast into the lake of fire where the beast and the false prophet were cast. And there will be a tormenting or a torturing or a twisting or whatever you want a word, whatever the word may mean, for a period of time, a day and night. And that might be a part of that 500 years or something like that, you see, before the new heavens and new earth came. How long? I don't know.
Another question from Mike. There in Matthew 25, where depart from me, first into everlasting fire, depart for them and his angels. I don't quite understand that.
Well, now suppose that we use another word for this lake of fire, or this fire and brimstone. Suppose that we use this word that isn't very popular, extinction. Because we have the expression that our plans go up in smoke. When the Lord judges these nations, and there's no resurrection there in Matthew 25, it's the living nations when he comes, and here'll be a lot of them. And we find that these folks have never heard of him, didn't know him. And there are a lot of people near today that have never heard of Christ. But it is represented as nation. And these nations are judged according to the way they treat Israel during the time of the Great Tribulation. And if they have sided with Israel and they have befriended them in their great time of trouble, they are the sheep. And those nations will retain their identity as nations, their names and so on, and their territory on into the millennium. But the nations who are unfriendly and do not help Israel in her time of trouble are the goat nations, and their territory will be divided up among others, and they will no longer exist under their former name. Well, we've had that happen in history. Where's Siam? Doesn't exist anymore. It's been divided up among other nations. Doesn't mean that the people themselves were killed and destroyed, although some of them were. And you could mention many others that during the past 50 years disappeared. Been divided up. Now that's what will happen then. There'll be a dividing up, a nation. And those who helped his people, he says, you've done it unto the least of one of these, my brethren, that is the Jews, you've done it unto me. And so these nations are gone. Now, just suppose that the United States would not be friendly to the Jews and would help even in their persecution during that time. She would disappear. As far as the name United States would be concerned, and territory might be divided up between Mexico and Canada. I'm just giving you an illustration. The name United States would be forgotten. In other words, it's gone up in smoke. That's the end of it. A Hebrew expression, just like as we had that expression today. Oh, I worked on that thing for years. I put it on structure form. I got every reference I could to this lake of fire business and so on. I just was searching and searching for the answer. And the only answer I can find that will fit it all around with all of its ramifications is simply that it's a Hebrew expression, a Hebrew idiom, and it means that's the end of it. No.
Brother, another question, and I'm not trying to be contentious. But that says that prepared for the devil and his angels. Is that a Hebrew expression too?
Yes, because they will cease to exist too. Right. And you've got the line now. Now there is another expression. I thought you were going to ask me this one. See, I was anticipating. You didn't hit it. There will be some who will be tormented day and night in the presence of the Lord and his angels. For a time during the millennium. Alive. In this life. Not an afterlife. There's never any such thing in an afterlife. But in this life, there will be some. And when we read descriptions here and there, and also the prophecies concerning the land of Edom, what it's going to be like in the future, I think we can find an answer to that. I don't know whether you folks are acquainted with the Valley of a Thousand Smokes up in Alaska. Have you seen pictures of it and read any on it? Well, there's a valley up in Alaska which has cracks in the earth, and they keep closing and opening all the time, so you never know where one of these is going to open up at any moment. It's a dangerous place to walk in. But there's live steam coming up out of these cracks. It's under terrific pressure. Now, you can tie a piece of lead onto the end of a rod with a piece of wire and stick it over one of those, and that steam is hot enough, it'll melt the lead. Now, you folks who work with lead, you know that that's hot. Now, suppose that you are banished into that region and made to live there for a number of years, not knowing at any moment where one of those might open under your feet. I saw in the newspaper just a few days ago that down in Egypt, a woman, been married about 4 months, was walking down the street with her husband, and all at once the earth opened up, And she dropped out of sight, and they dug down 16 feet and couldn't find a trace. And he went to the hospital, suffering with shock. Who wouldn't? You know, something like that happened in the time of Moses. Something that never happened before. But Korah and a great many of his tribe went down into the pit alive. And they heard their cry. The earth opened up and swallowed. Right in the sight of the rest of the people. And so a lot of preachers talking about hell say, well, there it is. Those folks went right into hell alive. Sure they did. But they died too. And they're just as unconscious there as anybody else is dead today. For the dead, known under. Well, you know, you see, we got off onto a sidelight here, but after all, I guess it's all relative. Just a little bit more on some of this. New Jerusalem is mentioned in Hebrews 11:10, and we have talked about that, where Abraham is looking for a city which hath foundations. In Galatians 4:26, it's a city which is above all, the New Jerusalem, the Jerusalem which is above all, and it is a symbol of freedom, whereas he says the Jerusalem that was at that time and overrun by the Romans, that was bondage. So he's looking forward to that. And another thing, when you run this down and you're studying this new Jerusalem and this new heavens and new earth, be careful when you get into Isaiah, because he says there, behold, I create a new heaven and new earth. Then you go on and you find that in that heaven and earth that Isaiah is talking about, there is sin and there is death. Then you begin to realize that he's talking about the millennium. And of course, there is a restoration of conditions before the flood in the millennium. And that's what he's talking about. He's not talking about this new heaven and new earth over here. Isaiah didn't know anything about that. We know it. So watch it when you're studying these prophecies and be sure that you search every bit of it and put it in its proper category. When you make out your charts here and you make your squares and then write out the things that are related in each of these squares, you see, be sure to get them all in the right bin. Sort them out carefully. That takes a little time, a little work, but it's certainly rewarding. Now, if I were the emotional type, you know, and could shout hallelujah or something like that and so on, which I never was inclined to do, I never could yell at a ball game. I never get that interested. I probably started shouting there in my study once in a while, but I'm not that type. Even if I do feel about it, I like it sometimes. And I hope you can get some joy out of it, too. They're talking about the gates and the walls and the foundations, no temple, no night, and it'll be the light of the earth. We're talking. Now, in the cosmos that we have here, the highest title we have of Christ is He's King of Kings and Lord of Lords. Above the cosmos, in the heavenly places, He's known as head of all things in heaven and earth and head of the church, which is His body. You don't find that spoken of in the cosmos. So, in the dispensation of promise, the highest pinnacle of Christ and revelation concerning Him is that He's King of Kings and Lord of Lords. It has to do with the nations here on earth, and also the all powers given to Him in those heavens, which is the third heaven above there, including angels and so on, and that's as far as it goes. Now you notice when this morning when we started out and we gave all the different references, especially in the Old Testament, concerning the heaven of heavens, nothing was told about. Now, who lived there? Or anything of the kind. In Daniel, we're given a hint that between there were principalities and powers, evil ones, and that there were messengers coming from up there, and especially Michael. And that's about as far as we get. Now we begin to get, in the dispensation of the mystery, we begin to find about principalities and powers which are above there, and that the church has something to do with them and is blessed in that place and so on. We begin to get more revelation about it. You don't find anything about it in the Old Testament. I have given you the New Jerusalem down here and giving you those references we were talking about, Galatians 4:26, Hebrews 11:10, John 14:2. Also, we have 2 Corinthians 12:2 and 4, which we read a while ago, and Luke 23:43 and I didn't mention John 3:16 except casually in saying that the hope of those, as far as I can see, who believe John 3:16 will be this paradise, the new earth, of a resurrection. And you find that in John 3 and also John 3:36 says that those who do not believe shall not see life. Then you get over into the sixth chapter and you find that those who are given life, who believe and are given life, will be raised at the last day. So John 3:16 gives us then a hope of resurrection. So it has two alternatives, death or destruction, or everlasting life and resurrection. That's getting down to basic facts. That is basic. And that is a place for us to start today. You can't start teaching the mystery to somebody who's not a believer at all. That would be entirely a mystery to him in our usage of the word. Getting first of all to see that death has come upon all men through Adam. And the only hope of life is Christ, who is the author of life. Then when they get life, the new nature, the new man, all these names are given. If you folks haven't read The Two Natures and the Child of God by either Bill Bullinger, you ought to read it. It opens up a lot of things. A lot of people have been blessed with that. We buy them by the hundreds. And people buy them by the dozen and sometimes more to distribute among their friends. A little bit like the little booklet, The Christian's Greatest Need. I had to buy 500 of those a time. People are buying great quantities of those to give out. A while back, a fellow ordered 100 copies of The Church to distribute. So on with these. I can give you, of course, hints along those lines. In the heavenlies, Christ is given a name far above all principality and power and might and dominion. And has a name above every name. That is in Ephesians 1:20-23 and in Philippians 2:9-11, he's given a name above every name, that every knee should bow and every tongue confess him as Lord, given his lordship. And as mentioned before, he's the firstborn, head of the church, and he is the fullness of the Godhead bodily in Colossians 1:15-19. Yeah, Philippians 2:9-11. I wrote an article on that a while back about the name. I have changed a little bit about that. Now, actually, for a name, a title or something like that, that would be it. But there is more to this word name in the Bible than that. He's been given a reputation. That's above every reputation. You see, a man used to could go to a bank and just on his name he could borrow money. Can't do that anymore, you have to have collateral. But there was a time when a man just on his name could go to the bank and borrow money. It's his reputation he had, see, in the neighborhood. And so Christ is given a reputation, a name. Everything that name includes and would imply. That's far above every name. Not a special name, John or Jones or Henry or what have you. That isn't it. Now, as she has suggested, Jehovah Elion is the highest name that we have in the Bible because it means Jehovah, the Most High God. And as far as a title is concerned, there's nothing can be higher than it. But this name in Philippians is more than it. And you can see that as you begin to bow. You see, the name of Jehovah was to be proclaimed among the nations. But it doesn't mean that they were just to know that there was a God and his name is Jehovah. That isn't the idea. When Rahab was talking to the spies, she knew something about the name of Jehovah because it was he who had delivered Israel from Egypt, brought them into the wilderness, and had promised them a land. She knew about that and believed it. It was the reputation of God that he was the Almighty. Nebuchadnezzar began to realize it when he said that he realized and knew that there was a God in heaven. More than what we would call a mere name. And that is, of course, what we have to realize. To know Christ in his fullness is no just more than merely a name, to see if we can pronounce it. It is a knowledge. And that, of course, is what Paul was praying that he might know in Philippians, in his great prayer there. That he might know Christ. Well, people will say, well, Paul knew Christ. Well, Paul realized there's a lot more to know than what he knew. I think I will call this a halt here.